Good evening, everybody. Let me firstly introduce myself. My name is Professor Michael Cox, or Mick Cox, a long-time member of the International Relations Department, now associated with it, currently director here at the LSE of LSE Ideas, which has a very good and great relationship with the International Relations Department ongoing, with Chris Hughes and many others within that great department. And this, of course, is this evening organized jointly by the IR department and LSE Ideas. I'm very pleased here this evening to welcome Dr. Pippa Malmgren to the LSE. When I use the word welcome, I should actually say welcome back. It's always nice to welcome back people who have been long associated with the school. Pippa, you may or may not know, but you're now about to find out, did, I think, both your master's here, Pippa, and your PhD in the Department of International Relations. Within the IR department, then, there was one very, very great woman. There were many, of course, but there was one that Pippa and I knew well, sadly no longer with us, and her name was Susan Strange. Susan was one of the great, wonderful characters of international political economy. She probably did more than anybody else that I know, certainly in this country and probably in the English-speaking world, to make sure that international political economy got the serious attention it did in the academic world. Susan always used to say, the trouble with IR is they know nothing about economics, which, of course, one responds to the economists and say, you know nothing about IR. But Susan managed to bring those two parts which should never have been separated in the first place, the namely the international relations, the politics, the role of power and the state on one side, and political economy and economics on the other together. And Pippa, as we were talking earlier on, just before we came in here, was saying, in many ways, this book, Signals, is in some senses a commemoration of the work of Susan Strange, and has been inspired by the work of Susan Strange. So maybe tonight is a nice kind of an occasion to dedicate this particular lecture to the great memory of that wonderful and great person, Susan Strange, Pippa, if that fits with you. It certainly fits with me very well, because she was a great friend of mine. Pippa has, of course, a very distinguished career, a former presidential advisor with George W. Bush, a best-selling author, a robotics manufacturer, advisor to institutional investors, former chief currency strategist at Bankers Trust and deputy head of strategy at UBS. And she was the winner of the 2005 Intelligence Squared Robotics Debate. And as I've said already, Pippa is also an alumna of the LSE. Her latest book, to which she's going to be speaking about tonight, is called Signals, How Everyday Science Can Help Us Navigate the World's Turbulent Economy. I think Pippa has some really interesting things to say from a political economy perspective. And while I pick up my notes, Pippa, are you ready to come?
I am ready.
Entertain the troops. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very often have. There you go.
Wonderful. So, yes, this book would never have happened. In fact, my whole career would never have happened without Susan Strange, who I remember said, there are no fences between any subjects. Academics like to put them there, sort of theoretically, but in fact, the landscape is a continuous thing. And if you can connect the dots, then have a view of the whole landscape, that will put you in a very powerful position when it comes to public policy. And I've spent my whole career doing exactly that. I'm going to talk about some very controversial ideas. I remember when I came here, Susan's work was considered incredibly controversial to say that international relations and economics were almost inseparable. And today I'm going to talk about things that are equally controversial. So let me begin by saying it's almost exactly 70 years ago, at this time of year, that there was the only meeting ever of Ludwig Wittgenstein and Karl Popper at an event like this at Oxford. And apparently what happened was Karl Popper began to talk, and Wittgenstein got so upset with what he said that he stormed up to the stage after about 5 minutes with a fire poker in his hand and started waving it around at Karl Popper. Can you imagine? Right? Saying, "You are wrong. You are wrong. You are wrong." And Bertrand Russell, who's sitting like you in the front seat, has to stand up and intervene to ask Wittgenstein to put down the fire poker. Okay? And what they were arguing about is whether there are philosophical puzzles or philosophical problems. This is a huge fight. Okay. This is a huge fight.
those are the days.
People. Those are the days. Okay. Today, I spent 10 years going to the Jackson Hole Annual Federal Reserve meeting, and I saw the equivalent, and I decided to write a book about the fight that we're having today. And I remember sitting there in that big room where all the central bankers are and thinking, there's a fire poker right there in the big fireplace. Someone's going to pick it up. And they nearly did. So here's what the fight is about. The view of the Federal Reserve is that we have to do our level best to create some inflation in order to save the economy from the disastrous effects of the global financial crisis. That means cut interest rates to all-time record lows, flood the market with liquidity in whatever way, from asset purchases on down the line. But this is what's essential to bring us back to life. There are no spillover effects from this. Now, the moment that you heard first Ben Bernanke, then Janet Yellen say that phrase, I got the reaction you just gave me, right? And what I heard was this signal. Literally, I saw all these emerging market central bank governors that went, or there was like this uncomfortable shifting in the seat. As they went, "Are you people crazy? Of course there are spillover effects. Of course, if you flood the market with liquidity, where do you think it went?" At that time, right after the financial crisis, all the money flooded into emerging markets, because I could tell you as a former banker who sat on a trading floor, if you give me free money, which is effectively what happened after the financial crisis, right? The policymakers basically said, "You just lost so much money. We have to save the system. Here, have a blank check. Because you lost a lot of money, right?
I'll sign it now, actually."
Exactly. So you're obliged as a trader to take the free money and find the riskiest possible thing you can put it on, because it's costless to you. Why not? Right? So where did they put it? Everybody on the trading floor put it in emerging markets. And what you had was the Federal Reserve saying there's no such thing as a carry trade. Right? More laughter. Exactly. That the money doesn't get used from one location and put to work in another, when in fact that's the only thing that drives global capital markets. So emerging market central bankers started to say, not only is there a carry trade, not only are there spillover effects, but the spillover effects are incredibly adverse to us, because what they're doing is beginning to be successful and create inflation for us. Now here's where we get to the Wittgenstein-Popper fight of today, which is everywhere you go in the world, every major central banker will tell you, look at the data, there is absolutely no inflation. Now many of you are students here at the London School of Economics, and I just put up on Twitter just this afternoon on the way over here a list of the things that you are paying for, like how high your rent has gone, like what you're paying for food, what you're paying for the London School of Economics, which I have to say, it was more than in my day, you know. I find it very interesting and an important signal that the data says there is no inflation whatsoever, and the only thing everybody talks about in London, New York, San Francisco, Dubai, Beijing, name a city, is my rising cost of living. This is an interesting phenomena. And it brings me to the whole concept of what I mean by signals. Now, it just happens, my father was a mathematician. He was Tom Schelling's right-hand man on game theory. He worked with Mill, who won the Nobel in 72. Sir John Hicks, who won the Nobel in 72. And he grew up in political circles doing trade negotiations. And I remember my father saying to me, you know, the thing is with the math, once you actually know how to do it, it becomes kind of an easy thing to use to obfuscate what's going on and basically to keep Congress out of the conversation, right? That you use math and models and algorithms partly as a means of keeping the conversation to yourself. But also, everything depends on what are the assumptions. And most importantly, all of that is backward-looking. So anything to do with models, data, mathematics, algorithms, by definition, you're relying on past experience, which may or may not extrapolate into future reality. So you need to add in stories and anecdotes and narrative and explanations of things to begin to understand what might be coming. And my word for that is to look for signals. So, for example, when I wake up in the morning, I don't know if you guys have noticed this, but the box of cereal is the same size as it ever was. The price is the same as it ever was. But have you noticed there's only about half as much inside these days? Right? Or tomorrow when you brush your teeth, that the aperture of the toothpaste tube keeps getting wider. There's a whole division at companies like Procter & Gamble devoted to how to make you use more faster, but you're paying the same price. The bottom line is you're spending more. They're protecting their margin by doing these things. What does it signal? It signals that actually maybe there's more inflation pressure in the economy than the data is telling us. So, for example, the last 2 years, I've made this argument. People have called me an inflationista, which actually I'm quite happy to be called. And they said, there's no inflation, there's no risk of inflation. And yet we've gone from practically zero in the U.S. to 2%, which is the target. And what does Janet Yellen say now that we're at 2%? We should move the target. The target is too low. We should be at 2.5. And I could tell you that within the Federal Reserve, the view is that we have been below average on inflation for so long, we should go above for a period of time. So what are we really aiming at? 3. If they're lucky, they get it to 4. Now, if you're an emerging market central banker, you're thinking, wow, this is going to have huge implications for my economy. It's going to raise the cost of living for my citizens. And already we've seen in the last few years record high prices for things like protein in emerging markets. We've seen the cost of living rise so substantially that the Chinese, for example, have seen a 5-fold increase in wages in the last 3 years, to the point, just trying to keep up with costs. By the way, in Beijing, I was looking at the number the other day, the average rent in Beijing is now 1.2 times the average income. Hello. So everybody has to share, right? Nobody can afford rent. So this is a very interesting question when you have all the policymakers telling you the only thing we need to worry about is deflation, and what people are experiencing is maybe something different. So now I'm going to talk pretty fast about how these signals seem to be playing out. The emerging market central bankers, and I'm going to use China as the voice, but they are not alone in this view. Their view is, okay, we understand the game here. The debt in the United Kingdom, in Europe, in the United States, in Japan, is so big, it can't be paid down. Literally, you could tax 100% of the citizens, 100% of their income, and you would still be left with a hole. So it can't be paid in a political economy sense. Technically, you could pay it, but the citizens would revolt. So from a political economy point of view, it's not an option. So it has to be defaulted on. So what are your options when you default? Option one, and you've probably studied this here at the LSE, option one is what we call the Argentine-style default. That's where you say, I'm just never going to pay you back. Right? You've studied that? Option two is you say, I am definitely going to pay you back, but it's just going to be a little bit later and a little bit less. We call that a Greek-style haircut. Right? You guys have seen that. Option three is the leader of the nation says to you, the citizens, I know I made you promises, like you could retire at age 65 and that there would be a certain amount of NHS healthcare services available to you during your lifetime, but now I'm broke, So I'm not going to deliver on those promises, and your retirement age isn't going to be 65. It's going to be like 93, right, which you all know. You've heard this in various ways. And the NHS isn't going to deliver, and maybe you're even going to have to pay more for certain NHS services. So this is a type of default, which we call austerity. All of these are vote losers. So everybody loves to turn to option four, which is inflation. Inflation is also a default. It is a surreptitious expropriation of your assets. And it is the way the United States typically has dealt with debt problems throughout its history. So the Chinese view is, it's perfectly obvious what you are doing here. You are going to inflate. That means the $100 that I lent you, you're going to pay it back, but what will it buy? Already we know if you order a steak in London or New York in a restaurant, the size of the steak keeps getting smaller, right? Because this is a sort of surreptitious version of the inflation. It'll buy an apartment in New York or a flat in London. That's getting smaller too, right? So effectively, the inflation means my $100 or my £100, if you're talking about gilts, it won't go so far. So one Chinese official I was talking to about this said, this is the Goldfinger problem. And I'm like, Goldfinger problem? What do you mean? He said, well, you know, Goldfinger says to James Bond, you know, once is happenstance, twice is coincidence, three times is enemy action. And the United States, your history is how did you pay for the American Revolution and the debt incurred at that time? Through an inflation. How did you pay for the Civil War and the debt incurred at that time? Through an inflation. How did you pay for Vietnam and the Great Society period? Through an inflation. And how are you going to pay for this darn mess? You've already told us. You intend to raise the inflation target. So we have to think now about what it means for us and what it means for the stability of our society. Because in every society, there's always a social contract. There's always a deal. And this was something Susan was very strong on. There's always a deal between if I'm the government and you're the citizens, an arrangement that we agree to. And so when you start to default on the social contract, you can't be surprised that you get reactions. Right? So let's say you as citizens agree to pay your taxes, you agree to abide by the law. In exchange, you expect me, the state, to deliver certain things that you expected to receive. So when I say I'm not going to give it to you, you start to say, wait a minute. Why is the wealth in my society being distributed to someone else and not to me? Where is it going? And how come you guys are in charge? So once you start asking these two questions, all the separatist movements around the world, like Brexit, like the exit movements we're seeing in Europe, like the social protests we're seeing in China, which the Chinese government is having to work hard to contain, like the arrival of Donald Trump on the political scene, all of these are answers to the question, why is the wealth in my society going to someone else, not me, and how come you're in charge? So it sets in motion, when you start to break the social contract, a response. Now, in places where you don't have a ballot box, you get revolution in the streets. And so one of the signals that I argued in the book that I saw was when the price of wheat went up very, very dramatically in the year before the Arab Spring, I thought, you know, this is the most important foodstuff for that part of the world. And already they're feeling the pain because the debt burden has given them no jobs. It's killed their hope of the future, as it has for everybody else. And now their costs are starting to rise. The combination of the two is giving them huge pain, and you make the wheat price go up, we're going to have some riots. And then we had the Arab Spring. Now, were there any mathematical models that could tell you the Arab Spring was coming? I don't think so. But was that a fairly obvious signal that would cause some pain? Yes, it was. So part of my objective here is to complement what economics traditionally gives us with this concept of signals. I'm not saying signals replaces our traditional approach in economics, but it complements it. So, for example, the Chinese would say, we're getting a lot of signals. One of them is that we get social protest in response to the fact that we can't deliver on the promise. I mean, what's the promise in China today? Xi Jinping has promised the citizens he's going to double their per capita income by 2020. And yet, the price of food has been going up. The price of rent, as I say, going up. The workers have asked for higher wages to such an extent that manufacturing has begun to leave China and move to two principal locations. One is Mexico, which I would say is the new China. Its wages are 20% cheaper than China. And the whole Mexico, Texas, Midwest corridor is probably the world's epicenter now of manufacturing and productivity. If I were a young person today, that's where I would be going, because there are jobs all over the place, even with the oil price down. The second most dynamic location, which will come as a surprise to all of you, I can tell you right now, is Birmingham to Manchester. I know, everybody goes, what? It's so interesting. I gave a talk for Knight Frank, the big property company, and I said that the Chinese were going to be buying in Birmingham. The whole audience burst out laughing. They were all Londoners, obviously. and I said, they're going to buy Birmingham all the way to Manchester. Everybody's laughing. And the guy who represents Birmingham for Knight Frank stands up and he says, I'm in charge of Birmingham. I'm selling record numbers of flats, sight unseen, to the Chinese. Why? Because with direct flights coming in, basically they all want to have a foothold here. Why are there direct flights? Because the Chinese can see that the center of additive manufacturing and highly efficient manufacturing today isn't in China anymore. It's in these two main locations. So they come here with their capital. This is huge for the Chinese because that means that when the recovery comes, the jobs don't necessarily go back to China. So they're now thinking, okay, what do we have to do, right? We've got social protest. We've got a promise to fulfill. How are we going to do this? So now let me segue into the geopolitics, the true international relations part of the story. Because it's interesting, central bankers, they kind of assume that when they're talking about economics, it's only monetary and fiscal policy tools. But if I'm the head of my government, I can use any tools I have at my disposal, including my military. And so suddenly, you start to see that militaries are useful in this context. Why do we see so much stress between the United States and China over the South China Sea? Why at this moment in history do we see that? Well, if you sit down with the Chinese, they will say, put very simply, we can't feed our population. We don't have enough water or arable land. You guys are creating the conditions for inflation, and you've hardly begun. Like, this is just the bare beginning. And already we've seen record high prices for pork in the last 3 years, which is the single most important foodstuff for the Chinese population. We see our workers demanding much higher wages just to keep up. So if we can't feed our population at the right price, obviously we're in trouble. So we're going to do what we have to achieve that outcome. 10% of the world's fish supply is in the South China Sea. So because you guys have decided to default yet again, because you guys deny there are any spillover effects, South China Sea, I think that's just ours. We're just not going to argue about that anymore. That's just mine now. Okay? What else is there? Okay, minerals, potentially oil, gas, shipping lanes are valuable in that part of the world. Strategic security proximity matters as well. But I think more than anything, it's about foodstuffs. So let's understand how big this international relations issue is. It's a signal that I saw in December, which I found that kind of everybody else sort of missed. So in December 2015, President Obama and Xi Jinping personally signed a memorandum of understanding. Now, that's a very big deal when two heads of major governments sign an MOU. And what does the MOU say? It prohibits the military pilots on both sides from making obscene hand gestures at each other while flying. Okay, how close do you have to be in a Chinese fighter jet that's coming in close proximity to an American P-8 spy aircraft? How close do you have to be to see the other guy's obscene hand gesture? So I asked the military people, and they said, 20 to 40 feet? That's how close they are. We cannot be students of international relations and not understand That's how close they are. We've had many incidents in the last, 18 months. We've also had naval vessels that are coming in very close proximity to each other, well within firing distance and definitely hitting distance. And both sides shout loudly when this happens. But what it's signaling to us is that international relations are now at risk of an escalation. And I find it very interesting when I talk to people in the defense community, they're very aware this is occurring. They have no idea what the economics are driving it. People in the central banking world say that this has nothing to do with us. No, I mean, I don't know what you're talking about. That's military. The Chinese are like, hey, we're going to use every tool at our disposal. I mean, this is the conduct of state power. This is protection of our sovereignty, our protection of our domestic stability. So we need to start thinking in this sort of new great game kind of way, which we haven't done for many years. Now, why haven't we done it? Partly, I think, because when the Berlin Wall came down, it gave us two big outcomes. One was billions of workers entered the world economy and systematically pushed down wages and prices. That meant that none of us had to worry about inflation for roughly the last 30 years. We've had some emerging markets with exceptions, but in the main, that was a diminishing force on the global economic landscape. It also gave us the peace dividend, right? So I grew up in Washington, D.C. I remember actually having to dive underneath my wooden school desk once a month for the nuclear drill. I'm like, why did anyone think you would be safer underneath the wooden desk if it was a, you know, ground zero nuclear hit? I don't know, but we all had to dive underneath the desk, right? So for my generation, everybody understood the peace dividend was huge because you didn't have to spend all this money on nuclear arsenals, on aircraft carriers, on military weaponry. You could put all that money into productive places like the economy. And so we had 30 years of the economy getting the benefit of the peace dividend. But the fact is both are, well, let's say we have signals that both are reversing, that we no longer have billions of workers in the emerging markets who will work for nothing. No, now they're saying, I need something. I need 5 times the level of wages I had 3 years ago. I'm not going to work for nothing anymore. I was talking with a girlfriend of mine, and she said, oh, the jig is up. I said, yeah, that's an excellent way of putting it. The emerging market workers have said, the jig is up. I'm not working for nothing anymore. So suddenly the landscape changes, and one of the controversial arguments that I make in the book is that there are many, many signals now that quantitative easing four, which for those of you who are not economists, it's just the name of the next wave of huge amounts of capital that central bankers find to throw into the economy. QE4 may already be arriving, and it may be arriving in the form of defense spending. And if you start to look at what nations are doing with their defense expenditure, it's quite shocking. It's straight up, both in terms of what's happening to defense stocks and in terms of what's happening to defense expenditure. Upgrades of nuclear systems, introduction of new weapons. If I were a student of international relations today, I would be paying close attention to that. But what I find is that people in the defense community know, people in financial markets, people who do economics are like, oh, I didn't know that. I wasn't really watching that. So the silo phenomena means that sometimes signals that are fairly clear somehow get missed. And I wanted to explain so that we don't accidentally drift into confrontation and conflict driven by economics without any comprehension of what's occurring. I have to say, in my conversations with policymakers around the world, this phenomenon of silos is so severe. Everyone's in their own little space that they find it hard to connect the dots. And therefore, it was necessary to step back and write a book that was very broad, that could explain this in a way that any layperson could understand. And I tried to use plain English and everyday examples to do this. So let me give you one more on the strategic security front, and that is what's happening between Russia and NATO. So from a Russian perspective, they have exactly the same set of issues. Now, driven by slightly different things. For them, the sanctions have made inflation skyrocket. Today, the Russians are paying roughly 50% of their income on food alone. Food alone. That's a shocking number. Fish is probably the most important protein for the Russian population. In recent months, the value of an average-sized salmon in Norway is worth more than a barrel of oil. That's an interesting signal. And so suddenly you see the Russians pitching up in the Arctic and the Baltic, where we find what? A lot of fish. Now, who in international relations or defense or economics is watching the price of fish? I can tell you it's me, pretty much. Right? Nobody is watching the price of fish. And yet, what a powerful signal. Tells us a lot about incentives and motivation. Now, that's more than that. I don't want to say that's the only signal that matters. But in my effort to try to heighten the awareness of non-data signals, non-numerical signals, it becomes important to look at what's happening in daily life that will stimulate certain behaviors. Now, having said all this, I would still be met by every central banker in the world with complete shock and horror that I am suggesting that inflation is already an issue. Well, I say not in the world. I should say in the industrialized world. In the emerging markets, they would all be nodding and agreeing. From South Africa to China, every single central banker from an emerging market is nodding, yes, that we have a problem. And the Fed would say, well, look, if you are having a problem with inflation, you should just tighten your belt, right? Raise interest rates, let your currency appreciate, right? That's your responsibility, it's your economy. They're like, excuse me, but you failed to regulate in such a way that we had a global financial crisis that caused a catastrophe for the world economy, that has killed the hope and belief of my people in the future, caused us to lose a lot of jobs and economic revenue, you know, GDP. And now you want us to take more pain while you inflate? Yeah, I don't think so. So this is interesting to think about. What are the vested interests and what's that dialogue look like? So that takes us to this concept that maybe we are in a new great game. Maybe we are in a new world of international relations, stress and conflict, which is driven by these economic factors. And the acceleration of defense spending into that environment ought to serve as a signal, a warning shot across the bow for all of us who are interested in international relations, that no one should be surprised by any of this. No one should be surprised on the day that we see an American and a Chinese vessel or a fighter jet actually hit. They actually come within a coat of paint of each other. Because we've had plenty of signals warning us that this is coming. So the question is how to get people engaged with this subject. So I don't want to talk for too long because I'm sure you guys will have lots of questions. But let me go to a part of the book that is even more controversial in a sense. Because I basically argue that the future isn't in the hands of some smart people in Washington or down at Whitehall or in Beijing, which is the way we like to think about things. But the thing is, I've been one of those smart people, and I was in the wood-paneled room. And I can tell you, there is definitely no crystal ball, because like I really looked, it's not there, right? The smart people don't know more about what's happening in the world than the market, or then the general public, once the public begin to look at this. But this idea we have that a few smart people can fix it means we kind of absolve ourselves of responsibility and we just hope it's being worked out over there. So one of the things I tried to do in the book was change a little bit how we think about what is GDP and what is economics. So, and this would be interesting because it's definitely, even Susan Strange would have found this a little bit challenging. So what I said is GDP is not a number. GDP is an act. And it's an act that you do, every person in this audience, every time you decide to reach for something a little bit beyond your current capability, I want to get that degree. I want this job. I want to build a company that does this. I want to become wealthy. I want to travel. I want anything that's just currently beyond your capability. You reach for that. That is where GDP comes from. It's from calculated risk-taking. And so the answer to the question, what will happen to the economy, which I get, by the way, from everyone. It doesn't matter if I'm talking to the President of the United States or I'm talking to your cousin. Everybody wants to know, what's going to happen in the world economy? The answer is, it all depends on you. Are you going to take calculated risks, or are you going to hunker down into fear? If you hunker down into fear and you don't take risks, then we're going to get one outcome. If you decide to build tomorrow's economy today, we're going to get a different one. And so the book, in a sense, is designed to increase your situational awareness so that you feel more confident in the process of deciding how to take your calculated risks. I go even further and say that every time you calculate, you're basically visited by two Greek goddesses. One of them is called Hubris. You're familiar with her. One of them is called Nemesis. She's been around a lot lately too, right? And what happens is your hubris says, I know I can do it. And Nemesis zaps you when you misjudge. And that balancing process is, I think, very, very central to the question of what will tomorrow's economy look like. So in the end of the book, I spend a lot of time talking about how people are already building tomorrow's economy today, which will go a long way to solving the problems that I raise. Because after all, if we can create more GDP in China, in Russia, in emerging markets, in the US, we will have fewer people asking the question, why is the wealth in my society being distributed to some other guy, not to me? Fewer people saying, why are you in charge? I'd like somebody new. And less surprises called things like Brexit and Trump. And I think this maybe is a broad overview of the concepts and the ideas that I've tried to put together. I don't know how much time we've got, but maybe we can begin to see if people have questions in the audience, and I can then give you some further examples of things that I see as signals. But anybody have a question so far?
Well, let's just firstly give you a round of applause. I will ask the first question. That's what I'm going to do. And then there's lots of questions. If you want to come sit down and do it, if you want to do it standing up, you're up to you.
I'll stay.
Yeah, great. One question, you kind of touched on it, but from your analysis, it seems to me pretty obvious that there are a lot of people out there who are very, very discontent with the with the status quo. And you kind of provide an explanation that whatever is being said, actually people's living standards are being hit. Seems that inequality is going up, if we believe Thomas Piketty. There are a lot of people out there who are not benefiting from the global economy, and not just people in what we used to call third world countries, but in the advanced economies. And we've seen some pretty clear illustrations of this. The Brexit vote in this country was not only a shock to political scientists at the OSC, but indeed to the whole European structure. The Trump phenomenon in the United States is now being taken more seriously, not less. We're seeing other phenomena. We can even see this on the left as much as we can see on what you might call the conservative right. So I just wonder if you could explore that a bit more, Pippa, to kind of think through, because you're a political economist, and I love the way you kind of, you know, you take the economic stuff, the material, and work it in. But where do you think this could actually go? I mean, because you talked about other things, you know, worker discontent in China, a number of other things, all these kind of things. So it's a globalist perspective. Just, could you work that one through?
Yeah, so let's look at the social contract in specific locations. Yeah. So one of them is in the European Union. And the way I think about it is the social contract in Germany absolutely precludes the use of inflation as a means of resolving this incredible debt problem that's bearing down on Western Europe, right? Absolutely precludes it. The social contract in most of the others, not all, but most, requires inflation to fulfill the social contract. For the French, for the Italians, for the Portuguese, for the Greeks, They must have inflation because otherwise the pain level is so high. So I don't know if you just saw, but the IMF watchdog just came out with their report on the IMF policy towards Greece, the Troika policy. And to put it in very plain English, they said, IMF policy towards Greece is causing the suicide rate to rise. I mean, you can't be more clear than this. Which is exactly what I said in the book. One of the ways, have any of you studied Albert O. Hirschman, who wrote Exit Voice Loyalty? Absolutely brilliant, brilliant book. He says, you know, as citizens, when your social contract is under stress, your options are you can exit. That's the migration that we're seeing today in many places. You can voice. That's ballot box. That's protest in the street if you don't have a ballot box. Or you can be loyal. You become part of the state apparatus infrastructure. So in the case of the European Union today, the pain is so high, it is breaking the social contract between citizens and their state. Now, people were content when they were first told, our policies will fix this problem. And they basically took the pain. But after 5-6 years, everybody goes, wait a minute, there's no solution. In fact, it's getting worse. And this is why you now begin to see that within continental Europe, there is a protest movement. It shows up in Germany in the form of the rise for the far right and the AfD. It shows up in Italy in the form of, we don't want to be part of this European Union anymore. By the way, I thought it was very interesting that the financial markets after Brexit didn't attack British assets. Okay, sterling fell a bit, but it was already down 30% on the Bank of England's actions. But what it hit were Italian banks. And what was the response of the ECB and the Italian leadership? They announced billions of bailout for Banco Monte dei Paschi, which had lost 98% of its share value. But there's no money for the youth who are experiencing something between 20 and 50% unemployment. Yeah, nothing for you. Billions to bail out the banks. This is when everybody goes, this social contract is not working anymore. And this is why I argued in the book that Brexit was happening, that it would come. I argued that the exit movements on the continent are also very real. They are coming. We can see it. They all have names, right? The French, they've got Frexit, and the Danish, they've got Dagsit, and the Swedes, they've got Swegsit. I mean, you go through the whole list, right? I find the fun really funny is the Italians, which is Itaxit. Anyway.
except they don't.
Except they don't, exactly. It was funny. I was recently with a former Swedish prime minister, who was saying, yes, we are sending Swedish tax inspectors to Greece to teach them how to collect the taxes. And I'm like, okay, but the thing is, given the pain level, the inability of the average person to generate an income, the guy comes knocking at the door. Yes, can he extract some cash from the household? Yes, but will you ever see the tax inspector again? Or will he disappear in the middle of the night? And, you know, I don't mean that in a funny way. Like, genuinely, how does the state execute this function if the citizens have no capacity to pay? Which, again, is why I talk about tax revolutions in history. And, you know, where did the story of Lady Godiva come from? It was because her husband, the king, was planning a tax crackdown on this one city that her family was from. And she said, I will ride naked through the streets of this town on the back of a horse if you promise not to go raid everybody's homes for tax. Right? That's also where the Peeping Tom story came from, apparently, because everybody was told to shut their windows, shut their curtains so they couldn't see her. It's the same thing behind Gandhi. Right. What did Gandhi choose as the point on which to have the fight with the British Empire? Salt tax. Right? Because it seemed so absurd that something you just pick up off the ground at the seaside suddenly should have a tax levied on it for the purpose of feeding the empire's financial demands, but doesn't serve the population. Or another one, which I quoted in the book, which I thought was just so interesting, was the actor Liam Neeson. When he was quoted about the Irish water tax, And I can't actually quote him because it's all X-rated. But what he said is, it's outrageous, the idea that Ireland would impose a tax on water in a country where it rains the whole time, right? But that was the suggestion, because the thing is, as the state recognizes the level of debt, it becomes more and more voracious and finds more surreptitious ways of taxing us all. And I list many of them. And by the way, some of them are not all negative. There's innovation occurring even in this arena, and one of them may be of interest to LSE students these days. I don't know if anything's changed, but there's a reason, and it's not a change in morals, that in the United States they're legalizing marijuana. It's not like they woke up one day and said, well, I think this is okay. No, if you make it legal, you can tax it. It's revenue, right? So there are all kinds of ways. Yeah. So bottom line is my prediction for the European Union, and I'll be very careful how I put this because it's such a hot and sensitive subject, is a bit like my view on Brexit. I think the social contracts are definitely breaking under pressure. The old system we've had is not going to last. The social fabric is ripping too violently. So we're going to need something new. So I love Europe. I could see a Europe with a European Union. I am in favor of a unified Europe. But the direction the EU is currently going in is definitely at odds with the citizens. And the one thing that central bankers have not calculated is, see, they assumed that if there was going to be a protest against the EU and the euro in particular, that it would come in the form of the political leaders. No, it will come from the streets. People will go to the streets and they will refuse this system. And I think that's what we're witnessing in Western Europe today, is the beginning of those
street protests.
And
also, without going into too much detail, we're also witnessing something similar in the United States.
I agree completely. Absolutely. Okay. That's why I say it's a global phenomenon.
Right. Okay, we've got a number of hands that went up. Can we get two or three here quickly? The gentleman over here, take that one. I'll pick up, if you want to field, one over here and one over here. I'll take, the guy with the tie. Yeah, please. Well, lots of people have got ties, but you've got a very nice
one. One
you've got
over
a very
here,
nice
though. You're
tie,
ready
yeah.
to go.
Okay, one, two, and then we'll go on. Okay, please.
I'm Robert Morris. I'm just a curious person who came here. Regarding QE, why does any government, just sort of push money into the economy? Why don't they instead give all their citizens some money so they know what, because the citizens know what to do with that money?
Yeah, it's a great question. So again, I was working in government when we had Enron, and at that time, 7 of the 9 largest bankruptcies occurred in 1 year, when I was advising the president on economic issues. It took probably 10 years off my life. But anyway, in that year, I can tell you, everyone felt this was the biggest crisis we had ever, ever faced and ever would. And I realized every crisis feels this way. So when the financial crisis came, you have to remember that Alan Greenspan told Congress, if you don't pass what was called TARP, which was the first big package of capital, if you don't pass TARP, there will be no economy tomorrow. Apparently everybody just went ashen in that room and they all agreed. And to be clear, TARP was a larger amount of money than a wartime budget with absolutely no accountability. I mean, it was an immense event in American history that much capital was given to the executive branch. But it was considered such an emergency that anything had to be done to save the banking system, because what everybody realized is that Lehman Brothers wasn't the only one. They were all illiquid, but actually potentially insolvent. They were all insolvent simultaneously. Mm. In that environment, everybody just sees Armageddon. So the solution was seen as bail out the banks. Now, that has started us down a road that's got us into an awful place, because what's happened, and it's the thing that happens when you choose inflation as your way out, is asset prices go up, and who do you save and who do you help? The people who own assets. And the people who don't have any, who then experience higher prices, the poor. And again, part of my impetus for writing the book was to say there are tremendous social consequences of the decisions that we've already made. And to be clear, I'm a red-blooded American capitalist. You know, I'm a Republican. So I believe that markets work. But what I believe right now is our policymakers have no faith in capitalism. They've lost their faith in it. And so what they did was to save the institutions, not the society. And it's only now that they're beginning to register that, yes, they save the institutions, but at what cost? The society is breaking as the social fabric tears apart. And so this is the fundamental problem we have to resolve. So the next stage of this, the next iteration, every government I know is saying, we need to put the money into infrastructure, because then that'll create jobs. But we know China just did that. They just put all this money into these huge cities in the middle of nowhere. And it didn't work. Let me, by the way, this is a good opportunity for me to mention something which you should all be studying really closely, which I think is the single most important policy initiative on the global landscape today and influence on international relations, and that is OBOR. You guys familiar with the whole One Belt, One Road?
Mm-hmm.
So here's the deal, what China says in response to what you're saying. Okay, all the money that we used to make when we sold these glasses to you guys, we take the profit and we put it into treasuries, gilts, bunds, because if we leave it at home, it creates inflation. So we're going to put it into your debt market. That lowers the interest rates for the United States and for Britain. It means you guys buy bigger houses and you fill it with more glasses. So then you buy more stuff. It's what I call a perfect circle. The perfect circle lasted until the financial crisis, which cracked it open because the Chinese went, wait a minute, why would we keep buying your treasuries and your gilts if you're telling us you're going to inflate? I mean, we're not stupid. That's a bad trade. So instead, we're going to take the money and we're going to put it into physical infrastructure outside of China. Effectively build special economic zones outside the country. Create demand for excess capacity of steel and cement outside of China. So One Belt, One Road is the strategy of taking all that capital and deploying it in bridges, railways, ports, physical infrastructure along the old Silk Road and along the maritime Silk Road. But it goes way further than that. And I would draw your attention to something I thought was a very powerful signal, which was the longest railway journey that's ever been completed. It was done in December this last year. It went from Yiwu in eastern China all the way to Madrid. One train. And it went loaded with Chinese goods of all kinds. It came back with only one thing, olive oil. I said, olive oil? And they said, edible oil, right? Like any edible oil. That's what Spain has, so that's what we took. That's what we need, is to feed the population. So OBOR, that's the new pathway for capital. Capital used to go into sovereign debt. Now it goes into physical infrastructure. This has massive implications for the value of assets, for the flow of capital in the world economy, for job creation for Chinese workers, because the jobs now come from outside the country. So you hear lots of things like the building of a new canal in Nicaragua, parallel to the Panama Canal. The widening of the Suez Canal. And just to be crystal clear, the new AIIB, which is the new institution that China has created to finance all this, opened in May with a balance sheet that's larger than the World Bank. Hello. And everybody, including the British, are like, I think we'll sign up for that thing. And the Americans are like, I can't believe you're doing that. And everybody's like, what planet are you guys on, right? Everybody's going to want to be part of this. So unfortunately, we still haven't reached the point where we can answer your question. Maybe just one tiny last thing I should say.
Okay.
Electronic cash.
All right.
You must watch electronic cash. Right. Ken Rogoff's new book.
Yeah.
Charlie Goodhart from LSE. Andy Haldane from the Bank of England. They've all said the solution is to go to electronic cash. Not because it's more convenient for you, the citizens, but because with negative interest rates, if you decide to save your 100 pounds and not deploy it into the economy for the reasons your question implies, we'll just take it out of your bank account overnight, $2 or two pounds. Now you're down to 98. That'll make you go buy a flat or put your money in the stock market, because basically otherwise it's eroding. In other words, it's a means of compelling the money to push into the economy. And that's a question. Is this the way we want to do it? I have grave doubts that this is the right way to do it. So these are, anyway, we'll go to the next question.
Chap over here. Yep.
Hi. What is your thinking process behind identifying these signals, and how might a business formalize that process in their strategic thinking in order to navigate the economy?
So when I started this process, and just to be clear, just a little bit of background, I wrote the book and brought it out at the end of 2015. All the publishers said, we know you, we know your work, but nobody cares about economics, so we don't see publishing your book. I said, listen, I go around the world, I'm talking to live audiences everywhere, everybody cares about economics, especially if you put it in plain English. I was wrong, by the way, because everybody bought Piketty's book, which is definitely not in plain English. So, I was right, there's a demand for economics. Anyway, I ended up crowdfunding the book. And we raised 269% of the target in 15 days, which was £26,000, which was more than I ever would have been paid in advance as a first-time author. And then we put it on Amazon, we hit number one 4 times. This is now the formally published version. And many of the publishers said, what we want is what you've just asked for. Because your book, they said, it's too international. They said, you talk about Cadbury's, and only Americans, they only know about Hershey's. I did point out that Kraft has bought Cadbury's, but this made no headway with them. They said, your book has too many ideas. Books today, you take one idea, and then you hammer it to death for another 11 chapters. I said, I refuse. I went to the LSE. I read books by E.H. Carr. I read Peter Drucker's wonderful book, The End of Economic Man, which hugely influenced my writing this book, which was written in 1939. And it was kind of his explanation of how society was being ripped apart. So I agree. One thing what needs to be done is a simple primer on how to see those signals. So what I've tried to do is actually create a community on Twitter where I've talked about things like shrinkflation and using simple examples. By the way, the Cadbury's example has been by far the most popular because I don't know if you saw, anybody here like Cadbury's cream eggs?
Absolutely.
A few people. Yeah, so I don't know if you saw, but last year they attempted to reduce the number of Cadbury's cream eggs from 6 to 5, but to charge the same price. And I have my daughter here with me today. According to my daughter, the quality of the chocolate went down as well. And the shell is thinner as well, right? Yeah, it's just nasty, right? So I created a kind of community on Twitter, and people send me examples of this all the time. I got one recently that paint cans, apparently, they're making the size of the tins smaller, and there's less paint inside, right? So it's all sorts of ways that it just tries to disguise to your eye, but it's occurring. I just put up one on Twitter that's not so recent, but it's interesting, of mackerel tins. There's 20% less mackerel in the tin, same price. So there's signals all around, but some of them are much bigger. Like, for example, how do we quantify, to your point, if what we're seeing is a populist uprising of the discontented, which is what I am describing, and all I'm doing is telling you the reasons why they're discontented, then how do you fit that as a number into a model, right? Brexit, for me, it's all about anger and anti-establishment sentiment. Show me a number that reflects that. There is no number, but there are lots of signals of anecdotes and stories and how people are feeling. And that's what I'm saying, is we have to learn to get more comfortable with this soft side, with the narrative, to complement the systematic numerical approach that we lean so heavily on and which fails us so frequently.
I've got two other questions coming. I've got a gentleman here in yellow, if you can give him a... chap here in yellow.
Right here in the middle.
Yeah, yellow with... And somebody else over there. Chap here, okay. Sorry. We need
Thank
someone
you.
To ask questions, don't you?
Evening, Pippa.
Hi.
What should we be reading into, and should we be worried about the latest election results of the AfD in Berlin?
Let's just take that, hold that one, the AfD elections in Berlin elsewhere. Yeah, and gentleman here.
Just with your signals, I can think of a really big one with the kind of negative interest rates and the kind of the pension funds that actually keep saying, you know, long term, fair enough, might take a while, but they're going to explode.
So two questions there. Thanks.
Yeah. So, yes, both are important. I think that definitely we are seeing a return to that. Well, let's put it this way. The debt burden is so heavy, it pushes politics out of the center to the extremes, on the left and on the right. And so what we're witnessing is that move to a more extremist set of policymakers, policies, a landscape. And I think it's accelerating. And the more pain people feel, the more they're going to reach for these new answers. So every time we see a new election result, we just saw Angela Merkel, basically, I think the signal is clear. She's out. She's gone. Unless something dramatically changes. And so everything we've hung our hopes on for a moderate outcome there is subsiding. So, yes, the signals elections are giving us are powerful. The signals of the general public and their level of discontent is very powerful. So I think we would be crazy to ignore this. And equally, I can easily see if people were surprised by Brexit, they're going to be surprised by the exit movements on the continent. And the one that is most controversial, which I've gone on record saying I do believe is a possibility, is the other Grexit, which is Germany. And the reason is because as the public sees the direction things go in, they basically say the system's not working, it's not serving my interests. We can see this in Austria. And when the Constitutional Court gave permission for the election to be held again for the new presidency, I suspect the far right comes in Austria. They dissolve the parliament, they go to elections, we end up with a much more far right, and their position will be, we want the single market, but we don't want Schengen. Who does that sound like? That sounds like the British. All right, and suddenly the whole thing starts to unravel because it's more than just the British. So I think it's a very, very powerful thing. On the pensions, I think this is actually at the heart of my argument. If the Chinese and the Russians and emerging market holders of treasuries, gilts, and bunds, and sovereign debt, Japanese sovereign debt, if they're not going to hold it anymore, and if you've looked at any of the numbers lately, they are selling very aggressively. It's not just that they've stopped buying. They're really selling now. So you would expect our yields to go up at some point, but they don't. So who's buying? Pension funds. And why are pension funds buying? I think it's a form of financial repression, and the pension funds and banks are told by the regulators, you represent grandmothers, and you should do only safe things with the money, asterisk. The only safe thing would be my sovereign debt. So if you buy my sovereign debt, you're good. If you don't, I think we have like 15 audits that might come tomorrow morning. Everybody knows this implicit threat is there. So then I say to the CIOs of pension funds, excuse me, but what this means is all this risky debt, you're offloading it onto the backs of grandmothers. And don't you think she ought to be told? And they go, listen, you know that, and I know that, but grandma doesn't know that, right? And so you're like, yeah, okay, we got a pension system that's underfunded, and now we're jamming it with the kind of debt that the emerging markets are perceiving to be too risky given the commitment to cause inflation to go up. Is this a social issue that we ought to be really thinking about? Absolutely. Hmm. Absolutely. It is at the heart of the social fabric of our system. It's at the heart of the social contract. And it does worry me that I remember watching a discussion of central bankers, and they basically said what I just said. They just said it in a way you couldn't understand it. Right, and I'm just putting in plain English. But they kind of reached the point where they were kind of uncomfortable. Yes, this is all landing up with grandma. Oh, well. And in a way, that's what Ken Rogoff says in his new book. You know, well, I think Richard Fisher recently said, well, you know, they're trade-offs. I'm like, poor grandma, right? She's getting thrown to the wolves here. Grandpa too.
Grandpa too.
And I'm getting close to being grandma and grandpa. You know, I mean, it's me too. It's us. It's all of us.
But Pippa, this is a good turn, is it not? For the last 3 or 4 years, everybody's been telling me that to be over the age of 65 is almost like a moral crime.
Yeah.
And that we're taking away the futures of all people between the ages of 25 and 35. David Willetts writes books all over the place on this. On this particular issue. So I find this is a kind of, a much more positive development.
I hear you. Well, another thing I find interesting, a signal, is the entry of people over the age of 50 back into the workforce as the elderly or older people begin to realize that their costs are rising, their rent is rising, their grocery bill is rising, their performance on their pension fund is zero, and you know, because their interest rates are so low, and the stock market, although it's record all-time high, it doesn't go anywhere. So they have no performance, so they have to go back to work. Yeah. I actually think this is a very good thing. We're going to bring all the talent and skill of all those people back into the economy, and they will work in a gig economy kind of way, so multiple different engagements. And if the 100-year life, which is the book that's just come out, it's on the FT's shortlist, if that's right, and I suspect it is, right, because we'll all, you know, I'm in the robotics world, I can tell you, we're all going to have replacement knees, replacement hips, replacement everything pretty much. So we're all going to live 100 years. Actually, retiring at 65, you'd be bored out of your mind.
Right. You're looking at a perfect example sitting beside you, by the way. You know. I tried it and it didn't work. Okay, we've got a gentleman here. I'm getting gentlemen everywhere. Where are the women? Anyway, I've just got to pick up the people. Gentleman in a white shirt and then some. And then somebody, anybody over here? Anybody we got over here? The chap here. Yeah, come down the front. Take two together. Yeah, please, sir.
My water.
That's yours. That's yours.
Hello. I'm talking about definitions. You were mentioning that government says there's no inflation, but everybody sees there is some. Now, for example, some years ago in this country, we changed the inflation, I believe, from using the retail prices index down to using the consumer prices index, which doesn't include houses.
That's right.
And you've got other things. I mean, going over to America, you have, you know, I think Obama is saying we have wonderfully low unemployment, but anyone who's on the unemployment over 6 months disappears off the agent and isn't actually considered anymore.
That's it.
And other things like that. Can you comment on that, please?
Yeah, actually, I talk in the book about chained CPI, which is a slightly different mathematical configuration. Chained CPI is exactly what it sounds like. Imagine CPI, and then you attach a chain to it that pulls the number down. And the Obama administration has shifted all the government workers onto chained CPI because it diminishes the payouts. If inflation is rising, the amount the government has to pay out is less. Because again, it comes back to my point. Inflation is a way that government defaults on its own citizens. So it means we're paying you the $100, but with chain CPI, what it buys is much less. So your standard of living is definitely falling. And this is how government reduces the debt. You know, this is why it's important to distinguish. Inflation is in the interest of government. It's not in the interest of the citizens. I don't know if you guys know Bill White, the central banker, who he always calls every major turn, and he's much feared in the central banking world. Anyway, he was recently asked, why do we have a 2% inflation target? Why isn't it 3? Why isn't it 1? And he said, because 2% is the amount of money you can take out of somebody's back pocket without them noticing. That's inflation. And again, nobody's seen it for so long that they don't really remember how does it work, which is why LSE is great. You should go befriend an Argentine and a Brazilian and anybody whose family has lived through an inflation, right now a Venezuelan, because they can smell it from a mile off. But the rest of us, we've lost our sensitivity to it. People are like, oh, yeah, I read about inflation one time when I did my MBA.
I lived through the 1970s when it got up to about 15-16%. So, yeah, gentlemen here.
Would it be better if the government stopped pretending that the published rates of inflation and the effect of quantitative easing was real and just let it go for a bit?
Yeah. So I one of the things that encouraged me to write the book was some of the so-called hawks at the board of the Fed encouraged me, because the only story that you get out of the Federal Reserve is the Janet Yellen perspective. So I'm giving voice to the other guys. And one of them, I had lunch with him, and I was talking about the gap between official data on inflation versus what people are actually experiencing. And he said to me, Pippa, I live in Washington, D.C. I can feel that the inflation rate is higher than our models are saying. What's wrong with our models? And I'm like, you're on the board of the Fed, right? You tell me what is wrong with the models. And I think the heart of the answer is, I don't think it's necessarily deliberate. It's because it's based on models that were created in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s that assumed inflation was on a downward path. And in fact, what we're seeing is a resurgence for the reasons I said before. Part of it may be also deliberate because this is how you protect government. So, for example, the substitution effect, this will be the last thing I say on this, but for the women in the room, I don't know if you noticed, but last year at the Bank of England, in the basket of goods they use to determine what our cost of living is, they substituted lip gloss for lipstick. Now, all the women are like, okay, this is important to me. lip gloss always costs less than lipstick. So the minute you substitute, the data point says my cost of living is going down. But the fact is, actually, I probably use both, and I probably use them in like 10 colors. My actual cost is rising because I'm using both. I'm not substituting. So the substitution effect becomes something we ought to question. Why are we substituting this for that? Will people really, if the price of steak goes high enough, will they really turn to soy? You know, I still don't know how to cook with tofu very well, right? So maybe I can learn how to cook with tofu instead of steak, but actually most people, no. Or more to the point, what I see as a signal is the use of food banks in the United Kingdom has started to accelerate very dramatically. And also, as people get pushed into cheaper calories, those are by definition emptier calories. So we're seeing a rise in ill health amongst the poor. And that's before inflation really starts happening and can't be hidden in the data anymore, but actually begins to show, as we're seeing with the Federal Reserve data now. So yeah, these are open questions we need to ask. In whose interest is the current configuration of the model?
I've got somebody over here, please. Yeah, this lady. And take the gentleman at the back here. Yeah, hand up there, if you could. Take two at a time, please. Please, yeah, thank you.
I thought there was one kind of debt reduction that you didn't mention, namely purchasing by the central banks.
Yes.
Which means, of course, that the effective amount of debt is much, much less than the headline amount.
So this is being discussed now, is this possibility that what central banks do is they take the debt onto their own balance sheet. So the ECB, for example. But the thing is, they've already said, you know, we'll take as collateral the plastic cap on an Evian bottle as, you know, legitimate collateral. Like, basically, there is no collateral requirement anymore. And still the debt can't get cleared. So this is a problem. But another idea that's being proposed is the issuance of 100-year bonds, which then pension funds would buy the 100-year bonds, and it would move the whole problem out into the future. That's a possibility, but that's fundamentally monetizing. That's moving in an inflation direction. If that happens, to me, that's a signal your rent's going to be higher in 3 years than it is today.
The gentleman over here, please. Yeah.
Hello. You said at the beginning that there are no barriers between academic fields. So do you think that the way economics has been taught is basically shown right now with the mathematical models and the mathematical approach that we've had and the failure to see the signals, because there are a lack of stories, there are a lack of assumptions, and us looking at the past rather than the future?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you know, I worked on trading floors with Bloomberg terminals, incredible amount of analytics, like the most expensive cutting-edge stuff. And you would think that we had a huge advantage because we had all this equipment. And yet, who got the financial crisis wrong the most? The people who had all that stuff. So having the math at your disposal isn't necessarily the right answer every time. To your question, again, one of the people I quote at the very beginning of the book is someone called Lady Ursula Hicks, who was Sir John Hicks's wife. And she was one of the leading experts on public finance in the 1930s and the 1940s. And so when my dad was Sir John Hicks's student, apparently Ursula would come in and bring them tea as they did all these mathematical models. And she would say to her husband and his bright research assistant, "You boys, you know, you could do all this brilliant math, but the fact is you will never influence public policy if you can't explain it in plain English." And that is true. And so part of the reason I decided to create a book that literally has no math in it about economics is to try to help the general public join in the conversation and ask exactly the question that you're asking, which is, why do we keep relying on a purely mathematical analysis when, A, it's proved to be so wrong so consistently, and it doesn't tell us about the future, it only tells us about the past. But if I were talking to the economics students at the University of Chicago, well, first of all, there wouldn't be any left in the room by this point. They would have all left, right? Because this is their value added, is to be able to do the math so brilliantly. So the question is, how do we reintroduce this concept of the narrative, the story, the anecdote, the signal that we can't quantify, it back into that conversation, and also maybe retest what are the assumptions. It's not just that the model is wrong. Maybe the model is fine, but the assumptions that underpin it are incorrect. And this is all about assessing the human condition. So we come back to the human side of the equation. It's because in the end, economics, that's the problem. Economics, we keep wanting it to be a scientific mathematical thing, but it involves people.
What would you have said to the Queen when the Queen came here to open the new academic building, Pippa, when she turned to a professor of economics here at the school and said, "Why didn't you predict the crisis?" The chap was, of course, deeply embarrassed.
He was.
Not surprisingly. What would you have said?
Well, I actually did this in the book. I actually wrote a letter to the Queen.
All right, okay.
Because when she came to LSE to open the new lecture theater, she asked the one question that everybody should have been asking, and no one could answer, which is, how did all you economists miss this? A simple question.
Yeah, sure.
And she got an answer from the American Economic Association. It was a British Association of Economists.
Six months later.
It took 6 months to end. Yeah. 6 months. And then they put this into the Financial Times. And what they said was, it was a lack of imagination. Okay. So what I said in the book is actually, in a way, this is right. And that what we all ought to do is go back to Alice in Wonderland, where the Queen says to Alice, "You must try and imagine at least 6 impossible things before breakfast every day, because it's always the impossible that actually happens." And this is the thing, our assumption that everything's linear and we know what the direction is, that means you don't use your imagination at all. And there's a place for that in the narrative as well. We should imagine scenarios. When I say we should imagine a scenario where the fighter jet and the spy plane come within 20 feet. Because we're not far away. That's like not a leap of imagination to think about that.
I'm looking at the clock now, and I think Alice in Wonderland is a perfect place where to end this evening. People can come up and have a word with Pippa after. I've just got a couple of announcements I want to make. I know there are other questions, but always good to end, I think, when people's hands are still up in the air. A polite reminder I'm written down here. At the end of the event, please notify members of the audience, which is you, that there will be a book sale taking place outside the theatre with book signing to follow on the stage. So if you want to purchase the book at the low inflation rate, thought I'd get that one
Thank
in
you.
For you, of £20 outside, you can get this very finely produced book out there. If you bring it up onto the stage, Pippa will sign it. So if you'd like to do that, please do so. I'd also ask you to look at events, the publicity for upcoming events by the LSE in the upcoming term. The real term, I suppose, begins next week. It says something about the school and the popularity of our events. We've got such a big audience here tonight. But please look on the events page, particularly of the IR department, of LSE Ideas and all the other centres around the school and all the other departments around the school, because one of the things that the LSE does is, as you know, public engagement. We've never been an ivory tower, and we're still not one, thank goodness. So please look to our events, because I think they're an important part of the public engagement that I think we should be much involved in, and we've been doing, I think, a very good job on that. And last but by no means least, I wonder if you could put your hands together to thank Pippa for a stimulating and interesting...